Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Florida State University, a preeminent institution. FSU license plates support scholarships for deserving students who enrich and contribute to our community, the state, and nation. More at fsu.edu/mytag. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Once again, Florida's official tourism marketing organization finds itself staring down the barrel of possible elimination.
Is there anything in the statute that makes sure that our resources that we're putting into this are truly getting leveraged by an industry that should be able to fund itself?
Also tonight, budget talks are already underway at the Capitol. When it comes to education, some of the numbers are drawing rave reviews.
Public education advocates, some that I spoke with, were kind of applauding this as encouraging because it would allow for a $350 increase to per student funding.
We'll also learn why Florida lawmakers are worried the victims of mass violence incidents could be harmed from public disclosure of visual and auditory evidence from those incidents. I'm Tom Flanagan. We wrap up the third week of the 2019 Florida lawmaking session, and this is Capitol Report. In the shattered remnants of the old Florida Department of Commerce came a number of public-private partnerships back in the mid-1990s. One of them, the Tourism Marketing Corporation, called Visit Florida. In recent years, that organization has attracted more and more general revenue help from the Florida legislature. But now there's a possibility both that money and the organization itself could be coming to an end, unless, as Blaise Ganey tells us, the Florida House and Senate can reach some agreement to keep the corporation in business beyond its sunset date in October.
Visit Florida is a private-public corporation that works to bring tourists to the state. Some people are questioning why Florida needs to be advertised when it has beaches, theme parks, and nearly every professional sport. Carol Dover, president and CEO of the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, who has also been a part of Visit Florida's board since it was formed, says those places do a fine job of advertising for themselves, but those aren't the places Visit Florida focuses on.
Many people think that Visit Florida is about promoting, you know, the big areas, the big attractions. I think that is not where Visit Florida targets. I mean, many of our larger areas in Florida don't need as much marketing as, say, our rural areas. And like Panama City now, when they begin to come back, Mexico Beach, Port St. Joe, who's going to tell people that they're back open for business when they get back open?
Sarasota Republican Senator Joe Gruters is sponsoring a bill that would remove the repeal date and make Visit Florida permanent.
They play a very important role in terms of marketing our state, especially when we have issues come up like Matthew, Michael, and Irma, as well as Red Tide. They make sure that people know that we are open for business.
St. Petersburg Senator Jeff Brandis believes Visit Florida is a benefit to the state. He just doesn't want the repeal date to go away because he thinks the review process is necessary.
I think there is some leverage that the legislature is giving up here in the future years. And so to the extent that you could extend it 8 or 9 years, I think would allow us to have plenty of runway, but also allows this to be reviewed and make sure that administrations are keeping it running appropriately.
In July 2015, Visit Florida entered into a contract with Pitbull to promote the state on social media, in a music video, and during concerts.
Sexy beaches, hotels.
After it came to light that the contract was worth $1 million, the then CEO resigned, although he defended the deal. But even though former House Speaker Richard Corcoran thought it was a bad deal, Visit Florida has been able to show it's beneficial to the state. According to the Florida Office of Economic and Demographic Research, for every dollar the state invests in Visit Florida, $2.15 in tax revenue is generated. So when people talk about repealing it, Longwood Republican Senator David Simmons says he doesn't get why.
But we keep talking about, or at least I hear reference to, that it's costing us money. That's not correct based upon the EDR numbers that I have seen. We're making money. Hard dollars to the state of Florida for an investment to the people of the state of Florida.
Carol Dover remembers when Visit Florida wasn't given the extra funding.
For someone who has been on the board for many years, I remember back when we used to get, you know, $24, $25 million from the legislature, and we hovered at about 82 million visitors for years. We used to constantly discuss, how are we ever going to break the ceiling and get more than 82 to 85 million visitors?
She said their answer came when Governor Rick Scott decided to add more funding to their budget.
So when we got $54 million from the legislature, then we jumped up to 91 million visitors. And that was our first big break from the 82, 83 million visitors. We jumped finally to 91 million. So that's when we knew it worked. The more money you put into marketing, the more people are going to come to our state.
If that funding isn't provided this year, the legislature will still be relying on tourists to come to the state because sales tax revenue is the vast majority of where Florida gets the funds for its budget.
Let's see, we have 1.4 million workers in the hospitality and tourism industry. So when you take the largest employer, the largest tax base, the largest tourist state, and then you want to, you know, even begin to think about, you know, not funding it, it's just, you know, I just can't comprehend why we wouldn't fund it. You know, it's definitely a model that's not broken.
As Dover explains, tourism not only helps fund Florida's budget, but also helps business and creates jobs. I'm Blaze Gainey.
On this Friday Capitol Report, it is the end of week three, and we're getting to that point in the proceedings where the imperatives of crafting a spending plan for the state of Florida start getting more and more urgent. If you don't start this process heading towards the mid part of session, you're probably behind the curve. And we're starting to get some ideas of how that is shaping up. And that is why Ryan Daly joins us right now. And Ryan, looks like at least we got some big numbers to play with now, huh?
Yeah. And, you know, I think you've got a tale of three budgets going on right now. Governor Ron DeSantis, in his proposed education budget for K-12, he proposed a $21.7 billion increase to the Florida Education Finance Program. That's the principal funding mechanism for Florida public schools. It's the whole shebang in terms of funding everything when it comes to public schools. And so when you look at the Senate and House taking two different approaches here, the Senate actually proposed more than what the governor is asking for. Senate came in with a $1.1 billion increase to the FEFP that would total $22.2 billion. Public education advocates, some that I spoke with, were kind of applauding this as encouraging because it would allow for a $350 increase to per student funding, which is when you're talking about education advocates, they really key in on that number. That's how individual schools are funded based on their enrollment. The House coming in lower than Governor DeSantis' proposed budget at $21.6 billion. That allows for a total increase per student of about $168. The Senate budget has some really interesting aspects to it. One thing that the Senate was careful to point out was that it has $600 million in their proposed budget in flexible spending. They were also careful to point out that that can be used for teacher salary increases. In the big Senate omnibus education bill hearings that have come up this session, we've heard over and over again from teachers who are talking about teacher shortage in the state. We're very low nationally when it comes to what we pay our teachers in salary. And in fact, in both the Senate and House budgets, there's a proposed about $234 million that will revamp the best and brightest teacher and principal bonus program. You're hearing a lot of angst about that, I believe, because what I've been hearing from advocates and teachers and principals, teacher bonuses are basically, it's a band-aid. It's not a long-term solution. If you inject that same amount of money year over year, you could have a path to increasing teacher salaries. One other thing from the Senate budget that I think will resonate with people here in North Florida. The Senate's proposing a little north of $14 million to help with relief for school districts that were affected by Hurricane Michael. Here in Leon County, we had upwards of 100 students shortly after the storm who came here to get enrolled while schools were shuttered up there in North Florida. I think that's one thing that the Senate is trying to take a positive step on. Also, the Senate wants to increase safe schools allocation, part of the FEFP, by $68 million. So some of these things that have happened over the last year, the Senate is trying to respond to.
Well, we'll be following the devilish details of the negotiation as you get the House and Senate going back and forth on all of these matters and trying to come up with some kind of a final single unified approach, which is going to be happening here in the next couple of weeks, Ryan. We'll be checking back with you and see how it goes. Ryan Daly here on Capitol Report. Still to come on Capitol Report, a former director of the FBI warns that buying prescriptions from other countries may not be the solution to skyrocketing drug prices.
There's some smarter ways to do it, certainly, than just opening up the floodgates of foreign medicines and surrendering for a discount.
And should any visual or auditory evidence resulting from a mass violence incident be restricted from public scrutiny? That question now faces Florida lawmakers.
You put a number on what a mass killing is, and you put that number as 3.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org.
From 1993 until 2001, he served as the 5th director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. This week, he's in Tallahassee. He'll be meeting with policymakers on behalf of the Partnership for Safe Medicines, and that's a nonprofit organization created in 2003 to fight counterfeit medications. Some key Florida House panels are now moving forward with Governor Ron DeSantis' pledge to allow Floridians access to imported prescription drugs, and that's what we'll be talking about with Louis Free, who joins us right now. Mr. Free, thanks so much for coming on Capitol Report. Before we decide what's going on in Florida specifically, give us the 30,000-foot overview. How bad is the problem of counterfeit medications nationwide?
So we think it's a crisis from a law enforcement point of view, but also from an industry and, more importantly, a safety point of view. We have in the U.S. What's called a closed drug supply system, which means that licensed pharmacists dispense FDA-approved and inspected pharmaceuticals. What's changed now is the escalating foreign manufacturing and importation into the United States of foreign-made medicines. And that's a direct challenge to a closed, albeit more expensive, but in my view, much safer pharmaceutical system. And what we're seeing in response to that is a lack of law enforcement attention and resources to deal with the increased manufacture and importation. And we're talking now about counterfeit medicines, about fentanyl products, about opioid products. And the police officers, the customs officers will tell you they don't have the resources and they don't have the mandate to deal with this problem. The other part of the puzzle, which is even more complicating, is the reaction of some of the states, Florida in particular, that says, wait a minute, we can get very, very cheap medicines from Canada. All we have to do is pass this legislation and then persuade the federal government, particularly the HHS secretary, to approve. So, you know, I looked at the House bill, I looked at the Senate bill, and, you know, without being sarcastic, I thought I didn't have the whole bill because it didn't seem complete. What was lacking there, from my point of view, and when I was a judge, I used to read statutes all the time, is, you know, a very elaborate infrastructure to allow, in the case of the House bill, medicines from any place in the world coming into Florida, as long as the U.S. and that country has an agreement, the statute says, to make sure those products are safe. Well, I don't know what that means. I don't know that the U.S. has any such agreements, by the way, with countries, particularly third-tier countries. The other problem with both statutes and both bills is, you know, there's no enforcement provisions. There's no criminal sanctions or penalties if you intentionally violate the law. There's no anti-fraud provisions. There's no resources. There's not even a reference to how this is going to be enforced. So when I first read the bills, I thought I was missing a few pages. But I've never seen such a materially deficient proposal when the subject matter is really public safety. So I think, you know, the political headline is very clear. We just sign this here, and then we'll get the federal government to approve it, so you'll be off the hook. But it's really a, in my view, dangerous and very, very flawed way to try to deal with this problem.
In the case of importation, let's say from a manufacturing country such as China or India, which may have lax standards in comparison to what we have in the United States, certainly there's a matter of concern there. But if you're buying from the Canadians, don't they pre-check this stuff before they would then hand it off to a locale like Florida to pass along to its citizens?
Good question, and the answer is absolutely not. So the Canadian government has, you know, publicly, repeatedly said, look, we're transshipping these drugs. They're coming through Canada. We don't check them. We don't vouch for them. We don't know the site of production. We have no insider visibility into the safety or efficacy of these drugs. Good luck. They're coming your way. So there's no pretense and no argument that could be made that the Canadian government is looking at those products from a safety point of view versus pharmaceuticals that are being dispersed through Canadian pharmacies and given to Canadian citizens. That's a whole separate regime. But, you know, we're going to be the beneficiaries of the pass-through, which is a very dangerous position to be in.
Is this getting even more of a concern because the latest number I saw, 80% of the constituent compounds in pharmaceuticals are now manufactured in essentially third world countries? How can any regulatory body efficiently and effectively ride herd on that kind of thing?
Well, I think it's complicated and it's expensive, which is one of the reasons why we pay more for our pharmaceuticals, because we require all these safety checks and controls and integrity compliance measures to be put in place. I mean, it's like you buying a car. So the car has components from many, many different countries, but the manufacturer is subject to strict regulatory inspection before that car can be sold to a consumer. And even in that realm, as we see with Volkswagen, you know, we have people from time to time who decide to play games for profits and end up with a very dangerous product.
So if the importation of pharmaceuticals from other countries is not, given the potential threat to public health and safety, a viable way of dealing with this issue, how do we get prices down? Do you have any ideas?
I think there's some smarter ways to do it, certainly than just opening up the floodgates of foreign medicines and surrendering for a discount. I mean, one way we talked about this morning is looking at what they call the PBMs. So most people don't know what a PBM is, but it's a pharmacy benefit manager. And this is a very opaque constituency that operates between the consumer filling their prescription and the supplier, which usually then sells the drugs to distributors. These intermediaries, you know, inventory products, hold them for a long time so they can manipulate price changes and fluctuations. They have a lot of leverage against the manufacturers because they're major consumers and purchasers. They make huge profits. They don't have them in Canada, which is very interesting, which may be one of the reasons why the health costs there are lower. It would be very smart and I think very timely for somebody to seriously look at, who this constituency is, why are they making high profits? And by the way, what do you do besides manipulating the market for price control and profits? Certainly a better area and a more likely area to achieve some savings than taking a chance with a foreign medicine, which, by the way, the whole notion of foreign medicines being cheaper, I haven't seen any compelling financial analysis. There's certainly none in the draft bills here in Florida. That's the assumption, which is interesting, but, you know, like every assumption, what's the proof of concept there? Vermont, as you may have heard, you know, was looking at the financial savings to be achieved by foreign importation of medicines, and they concluded that people would not be any better off because the cost differential was negligible. So that's a whole other issue that the politicians haven't delved into, one, because they don't have the expertise, and two, they're not really interested.
And perhaps number three, as you've already intimated, it is such a fiendishly complex and interwoven issue that it's going to take more than one solution, perhaps, to come up with something that really works over the long haul.
You know, I agree. It's a complicated issue, and there's lots of different solutions, some of which will overlap. But I don't see the solution as just selling drugs that we don't know much about their production.
Speaking on behalf of the Partnership for Safe Medicines, and that's a nonprofit organization created in 2003 to fight counterfeit medications, Bluey Free, who is here with us on Capitol Report. We thank you so much for coming in, sir, and sharing those with us.
Great. Thank you.
In place of lawmakers, conclaves of crickets have taken over the Florida Capitol. Not literally, of course, but as Gina Jordan tells us, things are certainly quiet in the hallways and committee rooms of that big building in downtown Tallahassee as House and Senate members have once again left town for the weekend.
Looking ahead to next week, hemp gets attention in the Senate. One bill authorizes the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services to adopt rules to administer a state hemp program. A companion bill requires applicants who want to participate in a state hemp program to submit a fee that will be set by the Department of Agriculture. An unemployment compensation bill would prevent certain victims of domestic violence from being disqualified from receiving unemployment benefits when they voluntarily leave their job. A church, synagogue, or other religious institution could allow a firearm on property in certain cases as long as the holder has a concealed carry license, and a religious or private school could designate a person to carry a firearm on campus. The Florida Driving While Distracted law would tighten restrictions on drivers. Being distracted behind the wheel includes reading, grooming, and using a handheld device. The proposal says drivers can be pulled over and fined just for being distracted. A proposal recognizes the value of film and television production as an economic driver and a creator of high-wage jobs in Florida. The resolution encourages a collaboration between the public and private sectors. It also asks for the Florida Office of Film and Entertainment's continued support of various programs to market the state's show business industry. That's some of what's coming up at the Capitol. I'm Gina Jordan.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, the Florida legislature could shield video, audio, or images of death from mass violence from the public record. Robbie Gaffney has more.
If the bill is passed, the public would not be allowed to get photos, videos, or audio recordings of someone dying in an act of mass violence. The bill defines mass violence as a crime that involves the murder of three or more people, not including the perpetrator. Examples include the Pulse nightclub and Parkland shootings. But Republican Senator Aaron Bean has concerns on what qualifies as mass violence.
You put a number You put a number on what a mass killing is, and you put that number as 3. Where did 3 come from, and why can't it be 2? Why can't it be 1?
Republican Senator Tom Lee is sponsoring the bill.
The idea here was to come up with something that tied to federal, tied to a definition in current law. There are several. There's 4, there's 5. But the one that seemed to stick out most to us was the one that I referred to earlier. I think it's used by the FBI, which is 3 or more.
The FBI defines a mass murderer as someone who kills 4 or more people with no distinctive time between killings. A serial murderer is someone who has killed 2 or more people in separate places. Florida lawmakers worry the bill's current wording doesn't protect survivors. Those injured might still see photos or videos of themselves. Lee says he has taken this into consideration.
And I understand that there are people left out of this, as inappropriate as this is for people to be getting access to this and publishing it out in the world, we also have a First Amendment.
He continues by saying,
"You can't have democracy without a healthy First Amendment. It just doesn't work." And so the ability for the media to access this information is important, and the broader it's drawn, the harder it is to get support for.
The bill gained the attention of the First Amendment Foundation when it was filed in January. At first, the foundation's president, Barbara Peterson, says it raised concerns.
It said it in the definition of killing of a victim of mass violence. It said all acts or events that cause or otherwise relate to the death of a person. So, for example, would that include a footage of Nicholas Cruz purchasing a gun in a gun store? We don't know what that means.
Peterson sent a letter to Lee, who later amended his bill to have narrower wording. She says the changes have led the foundation to take a neutral position toward the bill. Now, the bill says,
acts or events that show a person being killed or show the body of a person killed. I don't know of any media outlets that want those photos or videos. They want to see what happened, how law enforcement responded.
Peterson says what can or cannot be accessed will ultimately be decided in court. The bill is still being reviewed in the Florida Senate and has an accompanying bill in the House. I'm Robbie Gaffney.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaze Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Sean Mulcahy. Thanks also to Robbie Gaffney. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Be sure to join us again every weeknight throughout the Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Florida State University, a preeminent institution. FSU license plates support scholarships for deserving students who enrich and contribute to our community, the state, and nation. More at fsu.edu/mytag.